Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 171 on the most valuable real estate mailing list with David Lecko. If you're into real estate investing and building wealth, congratulations, you are in the right place. So my role here on the REI Diamond Show is to invite guests who specialize in building wealth, such as real estate investors and industry service providers, and draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars and more in the business of real estate. Today, you're in for a wide-ranging conversation on real estate investing and off-market deals. Many investors covet that rare, elusive off-market real estate deal, but the truth is, the only consistent source you'll ever have of off-market deals is going to come from doing the work to actually generate those deals. Mailing, advertising, marketing, calling, negotiating, and repeating that process over and over again is the only surefire way to step into your own continuous flow of deals. One of the easiest ways to generate off-market deals, is getting started at least, is to drive for dollars and market exclusively to houses that need renovation, since those are the houses that are most likely to sell to an investor. Today's guest, David Lecko, has developed a system, online software, to effectively drive for dollars, including a free download and access to a usable version of that software system, which you'll be able to do later on the show. So let's get right to it, shall we? All right. Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much.
Cool. So we got David Lecko on the show, and some listeners probably already know the name or probably know about the Deal Machine. But for anyone who does not know about those two topics and or name, would you mind kind of giving the background, a little bit of history about how you got into the business and then what business and your app looks like today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I originally got into real estate back in 2016. I was working as a software developer, and then I was I read Rich Dad Poor Dad. I got interested in the fact that rental properties could bring in consistent cash flow more so than the stock market, which, you know, can be unpredictable. But as long as I bought my rentals for cash flow, I was seeing that I could predict what the growth of my investments would be. And then any appreciation that happened would be just the icing on the cake. Didn't have to expect it, but if it happened, that'd be great. So essentially, I went looking for houses that would be good rental properties. I didn't see any that were listed online. None of those actually seemed like they were going to cash flow very well. And then I went to my meetup, found out about driving for dollars, and started doing that. Spent about 3 weeks writing down addresses after work. And so I missed out on a deal because I didn't follow up enough. I had spent all my time driving, and I continued to do that. I drove by one of these houses, some construction started. I then looked it up and saw it just changed hands, and I hadn't followed up yet. So then I realized I needed something that was going to let me pin the house quickly, get that owner looked up immediately, send out the mail so I didn't have to go home and print it or type it, and I didn't have to have any minimum number of mailers to send one. And that's what I built in the next weekend for myself, was like a really basic tool that became Deal Machine. But originally it was just for myself. I was really just trying to hack something together that would solve that problem for me.
Yeah, it's that's pretty interesting. It's funny, you know, you kind of have this Silicon Valley tech swagger with the answer. Yeah, I built this tool in a weekend.
It didn't look pretty. It wasn't easy for someone else to use, but for a first version, it was just for me. It was just all I needed, and it was very basic at that time.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. How much more effort, energy, and mindset did you develop the rest of the tool, or did you kind of have to end up bringing on collection of engineers or outsourced contractors to bring it to the place it's at today?
Yeah, so I did the first version myself. When I realized, you know, some friends wanted to use it, I put it on the App Store. And from that point on, I it started to get some organic traffic. I invited my best friend to be my business partner. So he actually owns the business 50%. And then he took over all the development. And then I started going to conferences. First one I went to was Sean Terry's in 2017, October, and started to see if anybody else wanted to use Steel Machine after, you know, a few local people wanted to and started paying for it. From there, today we've got a team of 40. This year alone actually went from 15 to 40 employees. And that's really just continuing to invest in the product and making sure it's the best that it can possibly be, going really deep to solve the problem of driving for dollars and then starting to expand out slightly to provide a great free CRM and also list engine, which is for pulling lead lists.
Nice. So one of the things that, you know, congratulations to the listener who made it this far. I'm sure they saw a driving for dollars in the description and are like, a lot of people turn their nose up at that, right? But I had Zach Booth on the show maybe a couple weeks back, and I think it's actually, I don't think I published the episode yet, but Zach and I were talking about how driving for dollars list is basically the list, the mailing list that is the least amount of competition and the highest ROI on, you know, dollars invested in the advertising spend. Is that the case for you? Maybe you want to touch on that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Driving for dollars is definitely the highest ROI. Whether you're trying to get, you know, your first deal and you don't have a huge budget, or if you're a big operator, your cost per deal may be fairly high. It's a great way to scale a driving team to get your cost per deal down significantly, oftentimes cut in half. So for one example that I love to share is Simple Wholesaling in Indianapolis here. They did like 324 deals in 2019. They started Deal Machine at that time too and hired one driver to start covering the city and ended up doing 21 deals from Deal Machine. So they could compare like what does it cost per deal for marketing and the driver for driving for dollars lists and, you know, pulling lists. And normally they're spending like $5,000 and the Deal Machine deals average out to like $2,400. So that was about cut in half at a decent sized scale. And I like to share that story for that reason.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And I congratulated the listener right now who was listening for actually tuning into the show in spite of that, because I think that driving for dollars, certainly for me, I got in 2006 and, you know, I tried doing the driving for dollars thing, and I've got these like, I've got like legal pads full of addresses and I'm putting them into the tax record. And it was a very clunky and broken down system. And it, you know, I'm sure my experience was like a lot of investors, and you kind of laugh at it, right? Oh man, driving for dollars. What the hell
right.
is that? And then here's this guy in Indianapolis who's doing, you know, 21 deals at an average deal cost of $2,500 per deal. And it's like, there's a combination, I guess, of labor and time or paying for it, right? Either you're kind of like short on cash and you have a lot of time, and driving for dollars works for a lot of people who are getting into the business and going to do it. But if you have a, let's say a rehabber or somebody who's got like 78 rental properties and they're flipping maybe 15, 20 houses per year, that latter investor is not really going to have the time to develop their own little driving for dollars kind of platform, and the Deal Machine kind of plugs in and allows someone like that to, you know, throw money at hiring the driver team, as you called it, and getting to the next level. Could you touch on maybe what the driving team does or looks like and how that fits in and works on your system?
Yeah. So, first of all, you know, if you haven't done, you know, 5-10 deals, I would highly suggest doing that. But once you do a couple of deals per month, your time becomes worth more than $15 an hour. If you just take what your total, you know, earning is for that month and divide it by 40 hours. And when that becomes the case, really the only way to scale is to start buying back your time. And one of the things quickly that you can do is like, say, hire a driver for $15 an hour. Or if you're on the coast, you know, that you may pay $20, $25. It's still way better than pulling the list from what we've seen. And so the way that works is, you know, I have several drivers. The way I found them was I posted an Indeed job posting for a real estate driver. And then as soon as I got like 100 applicants within the first couple of days, I messaged all of them because that's way too many resumes to look through and really tell who's going to be a good fit. So I gave them a quick test project, and it should represent like a hoop they need to jump through that represents something that they're going to have to do on the job. And so I say, go sign up for my team on Deal Machine. I can give them a link to sign up as a driver under my account. And then as soon as I do that, I say add 20 properties that look run down. That link actually has some videos they can watch to learn about what types of properties to add. And then once they do that, I say, text me, I'll Venmo you $20, and then we'll set up an interview. So that way, it cuts the list down from like 200 people to 4 very quickly, because only a few people will do that. But those are your drivers, though, because they're interested enough to do it and they completed the task. And you get them excited by giving them a quick payment and they know you're serious. And then I'll set up the interview and go over, hey, I want you to drive at least 20 hours. You can pick your own hours. I don't care when you drive, but I just want you to do at least 20 hours a week for me, adding these types of houses. And then we have a weekly meeting on Fridays, and I just give them feedback every Friday. I verify their hours and I pay them. But that's actually worked really well for me, because then if they're adding the wrong types of houses or if they're taking the pictures sideways, they may not know the picture is important because we're putting it on our marketing. And so that gives me the routine to just continue to give them that feedback, and they'll learn along the way without it being some daunting task of like, oh man, I have to do this like training. How do I do a training? You know, it's just kind of like a system that operates, and that's worked really well for me. And we teach all our enterprise clients to do that too. So the enterprise client is like the bigger Deal Machine plan that lets you have 300 drivers. It comes with the landing page and the training videos and all that stuff. But we developed that just from my process of hiring drivers and making that process smooth.
Nice. Yeah, we do like the jumping through hoops task. So when I'm hiring for my team, it's very basic. I love when people are listening to my podcast and then raise their hand to come want to work for Diamond Equity Investments. Some of my best partners in my real estate business today have been audience members in the podcast who then raised their hand, and they got to know who I was over the podcast and sort of like understand who our company was and why we were the kind of people that maybe resonated with what they were about and why they wanted to be a part of our team, right? They figured out our culture from that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't mind sharing the key to jumping through my hoop. For us, was like, I have them fax a resume. And like, you know, a 25, okay, a 27, a 28-year-old guy or gal out there is like, man, what are these people behind the times? Like, how am I supposed to find a fax machine? I don't even know what that is. But you're going to have to solve problems if you're working for a company. How are you going to sign up a deal from somebody? They don't know how to use DocuSign, right? They don't have an email address.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I love that hoop testing for solving problems, because most people haven't faxed something in a long time. And then, you know, them being able to figure that out is great. I've experienced the same thing. Another test project for another job has been like, send me a 2-minute video. And it's crazy. A lot of people will be like, well, how do I send it to you? How do I record it? And it's crazy. Then other people will literally just send me an email with a video they uploaded to Google Drive. I want to hire that person. I don't want to interview the person that's asking all the questions.
Yeah.
Questions are good, but some questions are just, you know, as demonstrated by the various levels of submissions, you know, I'd prefer to get the person that is really good at solving their own problems.
Yeah, and it's like it's so elementary. And to your point, right, Indeed is like such a powerful job attraction platform. And there's many out there too, but then all of a sudden you're overwhelmed by the volume of leads. And so I found that when we're hiring, you know, there's cold, ruthless cutting of many candidate there to not even take the time to read the resume they put together. And I can disqualify it by they send me an email with the resume. It doesn't matter if I emailed out my position and said, go here, that's where you know, need to see that. They have to pay attention to the detail in the ad, that says to fax it in the first place. So if you miss the details, not only were you not inventive and able to figure it out, but you missed the detail of faxing the resume in the first place. That's a problem. I want you to be able to read a contract and figure out a detail like a closing date or an as-is clause, or am I paying the closing costs or not, or is there a post-closing right. possession? You know, there's so many details in our business that that's kind of critical. And if you miss one on the job posting, then, you know, disqualified on to the next one. Cool. Let's talk about your business a little bit. So are you still running driver teams and still doing deals in real estate, or is it mostly a software thing for you personally now, David? Yeah, talk about that.
I actually have four drivers that drive 20 to 40 hours a week currently. And, so they're racking up the hours and the miles. And I like that because, you know, even though Deal Machine has grown so much, there was like a period of time where I stopped doing real estate deals to focus on Deal Machine because I felt like it was necessary. You know, like I needed to like level myself up to keep up with Deal Machine. But I've gotten back to it because and I love that because that's the whole reason why I made Deal Machine in the first place. And then also I get to be a lot closer to what the experience is like because I'm using it myself. And in this case, you know, I'm hiring drivers. That's still a user of Deal Machine, right? We've got, you know, 300 plus, you know, those enterprise clients that are hiring large driving teams. So now I get to use it from that level, which I've started doing again too, to drive leads. So I primarily try to take down rental properties and do as many BRRRR strategy deals. So that way I don't have any money in it by the time we're done. Does that make sense?
It does. How's that working out? Are you in this post-COVID environment that we're in here, November 2020, for time's sake? We have, you know, tenants digging their heels in, and we have banks not wanting to lend money. Have you had the pleasure or displeasure of doing a refi and buying during the last 6 or 8 months?
Yeah. So it's funny. I was taking down this property where I was actually trying to get a refinance right when COVID happened. And then they backed out at the very last minute. And so the next deal I did, I actually, I got two lenders like going all the way to the end at the same time. Usually you would only do one because then like the title company would have to work with multiple lenders at the same time. And I really convinced my title company to like, we're doing it this way, but they kept complaining. And then sure enough, the primary lender went dead silent. And we had it racked up ready to go with all the underwriting done. So that's how I've been handling it. I'll tell you what, it was frustrating on that first deal. I mean, it could make you lose a deal if you're not ready to put down the cash for it, or, you know, if your buyer's not, or it could just be really frustrating. So, but yeah, I mean, the rates are good. So as long as you have a lender that's going to close, you can get a great rate.
Yeah, true enough. Good time to be buying property. Lock in these sub-3% rates on owner-occupied and maybe sub-4 if we're investor. Do you strictly do buy and hold, or do you also do some like fixing and flipping or some wholesaling? I mean, four drivers seems like they would produce more leads than, you know, just a rental could handle, or am I wrong?
Oh, yeah. So I'm taking it down. It's got to be a good enough deal to where it's an amazing BRRRR deal. So I got to find the good deals. And you're right. Four drivers are more than I can handle right now and take down because, like, I don't have five general contractors. So I've chosen to kind of push the brakes on that. But I've got all the deals ready to continue marketing once I'm ready to get the next deal. Does that make sense?
Nice. Yep. So it's strictly a buy it, take it down. That's kind of your strict model then, right?
Yeah, but everyone needs like a full renovation. That's the business model of doing like the BRRRR strategy.
Yeah, and I ask, I'm kind of like looking to peel back the onion on that business strategy because there are a lot of people who fit into certain type of boxes. A lot of times somebody who maybe was credit challenged like myself and income challenged like myself, I gravitated toward like my goal was to buy, fix, and sell houses. And I remember thinking, man, if I could just like sell a house, fix it up, and make $20,000 on that thing, like that would just be heaven. I probably would never have to work again. And
right.
kind of happened. I made that much on my first one. I did a lot of the work myself. And to me, it wasn't actually doing work once it happened. It was like, wow, I found my thing that I really enjoy, and it's like night and day. But the business models that a lot of times I gravitated toward flipping houses, and then I kind of like I figured out to wholesale a deal to someone else and make a little money on deals that didn't fit for me or didn't fit my timing or didn't fit my budget, helped to fund the marketing. So like putting wholesaling on there. And a lot of people in today's market are gravitating strictly toward wholesaling property. They just want to buy and sell. They don't want anything to do with construction. They don't want to hold rentals, none of that.
Right.
Maybe they're building cash right. up. And then you kind of have the BRRRR model. And I have a lot of friends, actually like Silicon Valley guys and stuff that have like really decent jobs. They're not interested in flipping houses. They're not interested in wholesaling. They're interested in doing what you're talking about, which is, you know, buy them, probably do some work, maybe not do work, and then refi to get out all of the cash or most of the cash. And I'm surprised that, you know, you're able to kind of keep this off market strategy, if you will, of driving for dollars and having multiple drivers there, cooking with leads coming in and then doing follow up and all of that to feed the buy rent, renovation, rent, refinance. I forget the order of it. The BRRRR strategy. It's pretty cool that you're able to kind of keep that consistently going while running the other company.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I mean, if I have so many leads, like you pointed out, I don't even have to wait to repeat the mailers to get a deal. It's just like, all right, I'm ready for the next one. Let me reach out to everybody. And then because there's, you know, thousands of driving for dollars leads, somebody's going to call. It's just a numbers game, you know. Normally you gotta, and it's good to repeat your mailers, you know, unless you've got thousands and thousands of people on your list.
Gotcha.
A few months. That way you catch people, because their house has been run down for so long. They're not gonna just probably be ready to sell it the first time you send them a postcard. That's why we always tell everybody, you've gotta repeat your postcard. Just like any good sales advice would say, 7 to 10 touch points. But I get, you know, in my case, cause I got the four drivers, there's just so many on the list, you know, it's numbers based that I'll get a deal if I send everybody one postcard, if I send it out every once in a while.
So in a sense, right, this is a little shift in mindset. So like most of the time for me, I buy the list, I do this mass marketing, and then someone calls in and now there's a lead in my CRM. But it sounds like the way that you think
right.
about your business and the deal machine is it's more like the drivers put this in there and that's a lead in my CRM. And then my touch of all
yeah.
the leads is I push a button and 5,000 postcards go out to all the quote unquote leads, right, in your mindset. And now 4, 5, 10, 15 people call at the time when you're ready to acquire again, but you're not having to waste the money chasing deals and marketing if you're not quite ready for whatever reason, contractors, funding, refis, busy with deal machines.
Yeah.
So you're able to have your leads on the shelf and then push a button when you're ready
right.
to do business. Interesting.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
So you're doing strictly wholesaling yourself now?
No, I buy rentals. I buy apartment buildings. We do some wholesaling and we do fix and flip. And we've done 231 deals this year so far. Obviously, we do a good chunk
Whoa.
Of deals at wholesale prices. We had it's our best year so far. We probably did, you know, an equal third in each of Chicago, Atlanta, and Philadelphia. But we're fixing
Got
them
it.
Up and we're flipping a good chunk of them. Like, you know, we're making 20,000-30,000 on a deal because like we're bringing them all the way through to the finish line and we're
yeah.
selling them retail too. You know.
Oh yeah. You said you only keep the ones that meet your buy box and then you wholesale the ones that don't fit your exact criteria. That actually resonated with me because what I found is if you stick to your buy box, let's say like my favorite here in Indianapolis is a 1500 square foot ranch built in the 60s. That's, you know, probably going to perfect condition be worth a little under 200,000. And it's just so fast. If every deal is that. Cause like, you know exactly what it costs to redo the whole thing. Cause you just did it, you know, and your contractors just did it. So there's just like, it really minimizes error and increases speed. And so I've tried to do that too, is not take something down unless it's just very close to that type of deal.
Yeah. I remember, you know, I've been in the business like 15 years, give or take. But I remember thinking, like, when I got in the business that I had to try everything. And so, like, I kicked myself for, you know, 12 or 13 years, David. Like, oh, when are you going to build a house from the ground up? Like, when are you going to do that? Like, when are you going to, you know, in back of my mind, when are you going to, like, build a skyscraper? Like, what's going on here? Like, wait a minute. There's a certain niche. And I get good at it, and yeah. I build efficiency. And, like, even second-story additions are, you know, until we got to a point, we lost some money on some deals, and we didn't really have our strategy, and some of the renovations were really big. We're in the middle of some big, fat losses as we speak right now because we really didn't have a codified deal strategy. So the way you just said, 1,500 square foot ranch built in the 60s, and it's probably worth $200,000 after it's done. Like, you know what you're getting into. You know the style of housing. They were all built in the same era, and you understand the buy box. And for us, our buy box used to be like, you know, all right, we're trying to make this like spread, and like we'll evaluate each deal, and we still do evaluate each deal. But like we've discovered our buy box and our sweet spot is we don't want to do architectural drawings. We don't want to be moving walls. It's one thing to open up a kitchen wall. It's another to, you know, completely reconfigure the first floor of a house and do a gut renovation. Like in Philadelphia, you have to gut renovation a lot of these very old properties and open the floor plan up. Same with Chicago. Now in Atlanta, slightly newer build of houses. You know, the era of development was probably post-1950s for almost all the product, and even post-1990 for a good chunk of the product. And so a lot of those renovations in Atlanta consist of painting the cabinets and painting the walls and maybe putting some new flooring down. And it's like very basic versus the Philadelphia and Chicago stuff. It's kind of like gutting the kitchens and bathrooms to the walls, new kitchen, new bath, and then kind of upgrading the rest of it. But those the housing stocks there, both probably 50 years older in Chicago and Philadelphia or more. There's older sections in both of the cities there. Just because of their age than you have in the Atlanta market. And like now that we've figured out that box and we don't get into these like long-term architectural 18-month renovations, like that works for us. And it's the same thing. It's about speed. I want to be in and out of the project, every project I can, as fast as possible to mitigate my risk. Right?
Right. Now you said something I haven't heard before, architectural drilling.
Oh, architectural plans or drawings. Drawings.
Oh, drawing. Okay.
Yeah, it's my draw, my Philadelphia draw and the accent. So I butchered it up.
I like it.
Yeah. And as we speak, right, just because that's my buy box, I have a 10 unit building where two of the units were illegal. And I kind of knew it going in, but I thought, well, you know, a lot of these units in the city, they don't get picked off. Well, mine got picked off 8 months after I buy the building. And now I've been in a zoning change and I'm getting plans drawn and I'm doing all that stuff that I, you know, swore off and said I would never do to try to maximize the value of the deal that I'm already committed to and I own and I'm going to stay the course and,
right.
and build it out. It probably will be another year and a half before tenants move back into those two basement units, but I'm in trouble because I got outside yeah. of my buy box. And so the discipline really goes to show if you write your rules on what you're investing, what you're buying, and where and why you're buying that stuff from the beginning and you can stick to that, you'll have a much better time over the long haul for sure.
Completely agree. Absolutely.
Cool. What are your favorite? So you have an app that I assume has given you some insight to markets throughout the U.S. And so I'd be curious if that assumption is true, David. Do you have any unique insights, favorite markets, up-and-coming areas, or just like markets around the U.S. that operate weird as a result of your kind of view into those markets vicariously through maybe some of your enterprise clients?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can do wholesaling and find real estate deals anywhere, I've learned. And it's like, when you're going direct to the seller, it's just like a pawn shop business model where they need to get rid of the house. They need speed and convenience and they give you a good price for providing that. So that's been a point of clarity that I've had. I mean, I love Indianapolis. I love Midwest markets like where I'm at. You are in bigger cities, which is pretty interesting. The observation I've made about doing deals is actually associated with the price of the market. So in the Midwest, Indianapolis, there's homes here for like 20 grand. I'm sure you're not seeing that in Chicago and Atlanta. But there's kind of a magic number that goes with these like lower price markets. It's like 300 rundown houses, and then you mail them three times each. You're probably going to get a deal. That's what we've seen. But in Atlanta, it's probably 600. If you're in Orange County or Portland, it's like 1500, right? But if you compare, you know, buying a list of, pulling a lead list, which so many investors do successfully as well, it's going to take like 10,000 leads in Portland, Oregon, you know, for you to get a deal. So that just elevates the cost because you're mailing that many more times. So basically, driving for dollars is like always the lower cost version, but if you're in a higher price market, you're going to have to invest more to get your first deal. Luckily though, you'll get a good profit, you know, from that higher priced property and it'll pay off, but you should just have your expectations right about where you're at and how much you're going to need to invest to get that first deal. And then deals thereafter. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's spot on. It's the metric that you just described. So, you know, 300 versus 600 versus 1500 in Portland. Like, I mean, I guess it's proprietary information for the people who you kind of already have. So I don't know that that's like a metric that's available publicly. But, man, you have a pretty cool view there.
Thanks. Yeah, it's not like a statistic. But what it is like it's just an observation to help set expectations correctly based on my experience was just interviewing all these people who have been successful with our product and looking at their numbers and realizing there's a correlation there. So I say it not as like, you know, it's definitely, there's never a guarantee, right? But it's like, expectations are helpful. So you know what to expect.
Yeah. And it's an interesting market that we're in too. So like you mentioned with Atlanta, and I was on my podcast and one of the guys came on and he was talking about trend following. And it was a book by Michael Havel or something like that, but Trend Following, you could check it out on Amazon. And it talks about this guy's like trading strategy on Wall Street and how what he's doing is looking for price action to movement starts, or maybe he's following the trend of 5G wireless that's coming online now, and you get like a box, a basket of stocks, and you follow that trend up. And then you ride it long and hold it like longer. A lot of people want to get out too soon, but like you're actually buying in as it's rising. So a lot of people see, oil or stock or real estate, you know, it starts to rise and they're like, oh man, great. Take my profit. Get out of here. And then they mentally want to sit on the sidelines and not buy in because they have this recent memory of, you know, the stock was trading at, you know, $200 less, or the real estate was selling for 38,000 and now it's 75,000. There's no way they could buy in. And so sometimes the newcomer can come in and capitalize on the trend and pay the higher price without the recency bias. And then the 75 goes up to 150 or 200. And so like that's one of the challenges I think an investor, a trader, an operator in a market should be aware of as that's taking place, to not, you know, stop the buying even as the dollar amounts get high. And that advice can be like jumping off a cliff and they could get themselves slaughtered if they're not careful. So you have to take it with a grain of salt. I'm not advocating that you just pay the highest price for every asset and then keep going and trust that the wind will be at your back. But when I heard about Atlanta in 2016, that was the moral, right? The guy who was on my podcast, I'll make a note in the show notes with a link to the episode where trend following was mentioned. I unfortunately don't recall the name off the top of my mind, but he was talking about Atlanta and he's like, man, these lots, they were going for, you know, 50 grand. Now they're going for 70 and we bought them at 50 and we're hanging on and we know they're going to keep going up. And I'm like, man, I need to be in the Atlanta market. And there was houses all over the place. You could get them for 20, 25, and the Beltline was coming in. And, you know, it was amazing because now all those same houses are 100,000 cash. You fix them up and they're worth 200, 250. They need a full renovation. You can't touch any inventory anywhere in there, but you could buy it all for, you know, 20, 25,000 all day long, even less, and no one would even touch them. And that was only 4 years ago. And we're seeing that same kind of thing happen in like the West Philly, South Philly area and in the south side of Chicago, where the fix and flip investor is able to go into neighborhoods, right? A lot of the more mature, exclusive, better school district neighborhoods, all that stuff. People were flipping houses from 2012 to 2017 in those like little bit more premium kind of neighborhoods, you know, lower crime, higher desirability, and there was product there, and they could find it on the MLS. But as the inventory is tightened, we're seeing this new rebirth of the real estate investor adding value by doing the investing in neighborhoods that they still had investment happening back then, but now we have values where ARVs were 100, 110 in West Philly, and we're seeing them in, you know, 180, 190,000 in the same neighborhood, just like 4 or 5 years later. And it's a really good thing because it's allowing great, high quality product to be put out by the investors and like really make an impact on the neighborhood as people are buying those homes. And it's just kind of overall improvement of the area. I call those markets like sleeper markets. And I think a lot of investors have since picked up on that and are not as much of a secret as they used to be like 2 or 3 years ago as those trends were just starting to take off. And I don't know how much higher it'll go, but here we are in COVID and you have all this tight inventory. And like, you know, you look at any of these charts in most markets around the country and like the, you know, the needles are pegged like all the way up for things like median price and price per square foot. And the days on market is like, you know, 12 and it should be 38. So yeah, what are the deals looking like in Indianapolis? Are you guys seeing the same, you know, superheated trend here in the last 6 months like I kind of just described?
Yeah, absolutely we are. You just don't think it can go any higher and then it goes higher.
How do you grapple with the higher prices? I mean, do you end up, you know, finding yourself paying a little more than you paid like a year ago for a property and being okay with that, or is that is that hard for you to overcome like it is for me at a lot of times?
Well, you know, I can't really buy any deals from wholesalers because there are institutional buyers that are willing to pay almost retail for houses that are run down. And so that's fine. That pushes the prices up of the properties that I own, but the way I deal with it is I have four drivers out there so I can find my own deals.
Yeah.
A time where I think a lot of wholesalers would shoot out deals I'd be interested in. And I certainly don't blame them at all. They should be maximizing their profit and selling it for as much as possible. There's just buyers out there that are willing to pay a lot more than me. And I think it is because, you know, they're institutional and they're looking at their long-term analysis, some graph that I don't have, you know, that I'm not paying attention to. I think that really fits in with what I heard you saying previously.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the interest rates are low and they're watching these rising rents and they're tracking population trends. And there's certainly a higher level of market data that's becoming more and more evolved for people to make buying decisions on over time here. One of the coolest metrics, and then we'll kind of touch back on our driving for dollars topic, but a cool metric that I heard recently to figure out where migration trends were going or coming was the price of a U-Haul van if it was a one-way trip from New York to
Florida. Right, which direction?
Yeah, exactly. And it was very telling, like anything in the South. I mean, the Midwest was like, okay, but people are leaving Chicago right now. I can assure you that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's so funny. You could almost make money by driving that U-Haul back or taking it to if you took a U-Haul from Phoenix to San Diego, they'll about pay you to take it there, right? Or from like Dallas, Texas to Los Angeles, they'll take it because people are moving the other direction.
Yeah, it's wild. And it's weird. I mean, I don't know how long and how far back the trends go. And obviously population in our country has been going up, you know, over time. You know, births happen. And even though the millennials weren't having kids, they are starting to have them a little later than the previous generations. There's still a case to be made for the inner city. So like I joke about Chicago and people leaving, the taxes are high. And they're like that in California, and they're like that in, you know, New York City and a lot of cities around the country. But there's also the talent density that supports the high paying jobs and keeps a lot of spendable dollars and innovation in these, you know, larger cities and in cities in general, whether it is Indianapolis or Chicago or Los Angeles or San Francisco. I mean, there's definitely this. I mean, we're not in the greatest of moments with COVID, right? But that's going to pass. And I think that talent density will still maintain favor for cities around the country. And I think that's a lot. I think that's a big reason why you'll still see these large institutional investors coming in and buying this single family, kind of nationalizing real estate, if you will.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
So I like your edge of how. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask next, like, how do you find your deals? You said you did 230, 260 this year so far, right?
Yeah, we do marketing advertising, so we have our brand and we spend money to do it. I mean, we're continuously
right. Yeah.
Investing in marketing, whatever it is, radio, TV, letters, postcards, the whole list of usual suspects. Except we don't actually do bandit signs. I don't think I've done that in a long,
yeah,
long time.
Okay, what's your reason for not doing the bandit signs?
I don't know. I mean, it's blowback. It's kind of clutter, in the neighborhoods. I feel like it kind of gives a bad rap to real estate investors to kind of nail up these signs and, have that. That just doesn't really match with us. I'm more of like the corporate brand, my brand is more of the corporate. You're never going to catch me doing a yellow letter or anything like that. People call and they know they're dealing with a big company who's going to stand behind it. We care about our brand. Yeah. We care about the way we treat people. We want 5-star reviews from everybody, whether it's a buyer or a real estate agent on the buy side, sell side. Like, it doesn't matter. We want to make sure that we left everyone with a really top-notch experience for doing business with our company.
Yep, totally get that and respect that.
Yeah, so you mentioned getting an edge, kind of your own personal investing edge. And I'm going to add on, it wasn't your exact words, but you got it from doing off-market deals. And a lot of buyers, like on my list, everybody wants an off-market deal. And sometimes we send them an off-market deal, just for whatever circumstances. But the only surefire way to build yourself a consistent flow of off-market deals is to put together the marketing like we did or like you do on a consistent basis. And I think that that's really cool. I think the Deal Machine allows people to do that, and that's part of why I was so excited to get you to come on the show here and finally make time to make it happen, is because I think that the app is really special for someone who's just starting up and has the time, and is also special for somebody who's at the enterprise level, to be able to kind of like level up again, if you will, by developing this system. Are there any questions that I forgot to ask about that, or that you would button on to the off-market, deal strategy for any investor at any level?
Great question. I would just say a phrase that really resonates with, especially the enterprise size, is like scaling to get better, not just bigger. And I feel like really proud of like when somebody comes to us for that purpose, that's what we're helping them do, is get that cost per deal down, putting in a system in place so that driver is going to be performing at peak without, you having to worry about them following your process. Instead of, scaling to maybe another market before they're ready, and that just amplifying their problems. We help them kind of improve their business that way. Couple updates you might be interested in is we've had route tracking. So like it tells you how long ago your driver drove, it tells you how long they've driven, how many miles, so that way there's like a lot of accountability for them to report their hours accurately and how you're paying them. But a new thing that we're about to launch is actually like a route planner. So you can like guide your drivers towards certain zip codes. The system will like guide them like a GPS down like every street that would fall under your criteria. And that's really just like the next level, because, your drivers always want to know like, oh, where do I drive? And typically, you'll tell them what to look for, general area. But I'm really, really excited about just adding, a systematic way of just organizing your team in that way. So that's coming out November 30th.
Nice. Which will probably be just a few days after this one goes live.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Yes, sir. Cool. I know that the time is getting short here. So I have a couple questions here as we wrap up. What would be one or two books that you would recommend? One book, maybe, newer real estate investor, maybe you wish you read in 2016 when you were getting in, and then one book that you might make to somebody who was an enterprise client, doing a lot of business and trying to scale better versus, you know, just getting started? Like, what would those books be?
Yeah. Okay. Great question. Go Giver, great one to start out with. You know, as you're learning, try to teach somebody. That really encourages you to make sure you've mastered the subject. Piece of advice, if I had to go back to my 18-year-old self, would be like, do one thing at a time. I see it time and time again. Every real estate investor is trying to do, you know, let's say they're just starting out. They're trying cold calling. They're trying emailing. They're trying, you know, yellow letters. They're trying driving for dollars. They're trying to pull a lead list. But even at the, like, mastery level, like in Collective Genius, you got to be doing 50 deals a year to get in that mastermind. And it's frequent. Like a newcomer will say, oh, I learned so much in my first meeting. I tried to do everything and then forgot to see what stuck to the wall. And now I'm out of money. So I think just like solid piece of advice there would be, just one thing at a time, master that and then go on to the next. But yeah, book for enterprise clients. It's for technology. This is by a technology CEO coach, but, it's called The Great CEO Within, and it's such like a beautiful prescriptive book for somebody that is, you know, going from the entrepreneur to like a full-fledged CEO operating a business that's scaling. So like stuff we've learned from that and implemented from that is, meeting cadence, leadership team meeting, all hands meeting, like what's the agenda for those? Precision scorecards. So like every one of my direct reports, you know, they've got five key metrics. We measure it weekly, make sure that people are staying on track. And then feedback has been amazing. It's been life changing. This book tells you how to do it. And then like every month, our entire leadership team gives each other like round robin feedback, and you have to give something like tough. You know, it's got to be real. And, the structure is really simple. It goes, I can show you if you're interested.
All right.
Yeah. So you basically say, like, hey, you know, I really like that, you send these emails out, but I wish that, so it's I like, and then I wish that, you know, you wouldn't throw me under the bus like you did in last week's email. And then they can choose to either accept it or reject it. That's the beautiful part too, is it just provides a structure so everybody feels comfortable on giving feedback frequently without offending people. And so that little structure there is just like unlocked communication for me, and I feel like the rest of our team.
So is it actually using the terminology? It's kind of like a template of, hey, I like that you sent the emails out, but I wish you wouldn't have kind of mentioned me that way. So is it the I like and I wish template that sort of psychologically, I don't know, makes it less of an attack, if I have it right?
Totally. It's right. It's like it's the most simple thing, but without it, I myself and then people in general, I've noticed on our team that would really struggle. Because they don't want to offend them. So then they don't say anything at all. Or the first thing they say is like, you suck, you know, or like that's how it is received, because they didn't start with like smoothing it over with what they liked. And so it result, you know, before nobody was giving feedback in the first place. And then when they did, it was like, you know, offensive because they weren't doing it because they were scared to be, they were scared about offending somebody. But yeah, the structure just give somebody like a good framework. And then we do it so frequently now, you know, you're not worried about the person hating you because literally everyone's like giving this feedback in front of everyone else.
Nice. I like it. So if you had another crown jewel of wisdom, maybe it was to do one thing at a time, but if you would share with yourself, it could be real estate related, life related, any type of crown jewel of wisdom that you would share with yourself, maybe 2016 when you first got into business, what would that be?
Right. Yeah, I saw that as your question and I got excited and I answered it first already.
Gotcha.
I think it applies to all levels. It's like, you know, don't start something new unless everything else you've got on lockdown mastered.
I think it's also relevant too. I mean, for me, I tried to do all that stuff. Like I mentioned, you know, kicking myself wanting to build new construction, do this, you know, pop the top on a house just because I saw other people doing it.
Right.
Kind of shiny objects in the syndrome, if you will. instead of going deep on one particular thing, such as, you know, could be driving for dollars and becoming really good at that and understanding your market. It could be, you know, developing direct mail campaigns. And, you know, I spend a lot of my life, you know, doing advertising stuff at the helm of the company. And that probably wouldn't be most people's, you know, guess as far as what I would do with my time. But good call. So, David, how can listeners get more information about you or maybe even download the Deal Machine?
You got to go to reidealmachine.com. And then for me, my email is david@dealmachine.com.
All right. Well, hey, I appreciate you closing the door, blocking out the distractions, and giving us your time here, David. I have pages of notes, and I had a great time. Thanks.
Yeah, me too. I really, really appreciate you having me on. I enjoyed the discussion. I felt like it was like we were sitting down to have drinks.
Nice, nice. Yeah, that's the goal. You know, nice conversation. That. Yeah, cool.
Off-market real estate deals. All of us real estate investors covet that rare, profitable off-market real estate deal, often bought with very little competition. The problem is many investors futilely try to develop their source of off-market deals through real estate agents or wholesalers, only to become frustrated when they discover that they are not the only buyer in that real estate agent or wholesaler's network. The only real way to have a consistent source of off-market real estate deals is to develop a business of attracting those deals. Enter the REI Deal Machine, originally developed as a resource for high-volume investors to build teams of drivers who are literally driving their market looking for rundown and distressed property. The REI Deal Machine simplifies the process of route tracking, lead generation, and literal push-button marketing to allow you to focus on the highest value skill set a real estate investor can build, and that is negotiating profitable real estate deals. For a limited time, you can register for free access to the REI Deal Machine at reidealmachine.com. You'll have a chance to play around with the system, take a demo, and actually begin using the app at no cost. So go register free right now at reidealmachine.com. Thanks again for tuning in. Remember to review and subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. You can check out the 170 episode archive of Wealth Building Real Estate Investment Jewels of Wisdom at reidiamonds.com. My main business is buying and selling houses, 223 bought and sold in 2019, and 241 bought and sold so far in 2020. We currently have another 129 houses in our inventory, either under construction, for sale, or sold, and awaiting closing. So here are three ways you and I can do business. Number one, if you buy houses in Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, go to dealswithroi.com and sign up for the correct buyers list. There are five in total, separated by region, and we offer our deal flow there pre-construction if you'd like to buy it. If not, we'll do the renovation. When we hire and when we are looking for new talent, new partnerships, if you will, we also post those positions under the careers link at that site as well. That's dealswithroi.com. Number two, if you're an accredited investor and you enjoy double-digit returns on your capital and might consider passively funding a deal of mine, go to fundrehabdeals.com and sign up to receive private mortgage investment opportunity emails. Number three, if you have a deal for sale in either Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. We are at the conclusion, my friend.
Next up, we are joined by financial advisor and tax deferral consultant Carl Warden to do a deep dive on how to defer taxes on the sale of any highly appreciated asset. We're not just talking real estate here, but any highly appreciated asset, such as second homes, primary homes, or even a business. So I'll catch you and that topic on the next one, my friend.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.